be with you again. What I want us to do this morning in Sunday school is just pick up the theme that we began last week with regard to omnipresence, or what our confession calls immensity. What I had set out to do and surely will not accomplish is covering immensity and eternality. But what we might do is finish up some thoughts on God's omnipresence and at least begin to make our way into a discussion of His eternality. These two attributes of God are placed together side by side in our confession. You don't have to turn there, but from Confession chapter 2, section 1, speaks about God who cannot be comprehended by any but Himself, a most pure spirit, invisible without body, parts, or passions, who alone only hath immortality, dwelling in light which no man can approach unto, who is immutable. And then our two doctrines I wanted us to look at: immense, eternal, incomprehensible, almighty, every way, infinite, most wise, most holy, most free, most absolute. I'll leave it with that and pick up again with this idea of immensity. And we began looking at this last week, various texts which indicate God's presence, and we looked at some that I like to say describe an intensive omnipresence. We looked at others that seem to suggest an extensive omnipresence, intensive omnipresence, meaning that presence of God that is as near to us as our very act of being. We get this idea in Paul's words in Acts 17:28 when he says to the Athenians, he says in verse 27, you know, God has set, in 26, God has set every man his place and his time so that he may find him, though he is not far from each one of us. He says this in 27. And then the question, not stated but seemingly implied, is, well, how close is not far? And in a sense, he says, well, how about this? In him we live, move, and have our being. A reminder that he's not saying that to a group of believers. He's saying that to unbelievers. And then he cites the poet, even as one of your own poets has said, we are his children, or we are his offspring. The idea is that general sense of we are those produced by him in his image. And Paul is, in this instance, grounding God's nearness to us as the one who gives to all. Back in verse 25, he said that we receive from him life, breath, and all things. And the all things really is all things, even down to the level of the very act of existence. There's nothing more intimate and pervasive in you than your being, as opposed to not. In other words, there's nothing you are that isn't touched by being. Obviously, that wouldn't make sense. And so Paul says, with regard to God's presence, how far is he? Well, he's as near to you as anything you are is near to you. Augustine used to say that God is nearer to us than we are to ourselves. What does he mean by that? There's a sense in which even, I don't want to go off into this at great length, but I think it's an important thought that he brings up. There's a sense in which parts of ourselves are remote to or distant from other parts of ourselves. It's the reason why you sometimes have a hard time understanding even your own self. I don't just mean materially. I mean, you have a hard time understanding even your own heart. There is this kind of, if I can put it this way, even within you, you're a complete unit, a singular human being, and yet even within you, there is this kind of distance between parts of things. And yet with God, there is no distance between him and anything that concerns you. He is as near to you as the very act of your existing. So how near is God to us? He couldn't be nearer. Perhaps we could say it like that. On the other hand, we look at texts like what we find in Jeremiah 22, 23, and 24. I won't read it, but the context is the false prophets who are saying, the Lord sent me, and they're telling prophecies in his name, but he did not send them. And there's a sense, and God confronts them through the prophet, in effect saying, how could you imagine that you could tell these lies and that somehow God wouldn't know? Do not I fill heaven and earth, declares the Lord. I call this extensive omnipresence. There's no where in which God is absent. This is what's interesting. If you take them both together, and we should take them both together, there's no where God is absent. There is no, you know, as the unbeliever often does, he mistakenly tries to hide himself from the presence of the Lord. In fact, it's of the nature of sin to suppress in unrighteousness this reality. right? So they heard the sound of the Lord God walking in the garden in the cool of the day. And what did they do? They did the impossible. Which of course they didn't. They hid themselves from the presence of the Lord, imagining that somehow there was, you know, this little godless place where they could hide out. And it's not only Adam and Eve that do it. Others do it. Even in pictures of the eschaton given by the prophets, there will be those that hide themselves in the mountains and they cry upon the rocks to fall upon them, to hide them from the Lord. Amos talks about those who try to ascend to heaven or descend to the depths of the sea. Interestingly, just like David says in Psalm 139, though I ascend to heaven, you are there. Though I make my bed in Sheol, you are there. Even you know, if take the wings of the dawn, dwell in the remotest part of the sea. Amos grabs that same imagery, turns it around, applies it to unbelievers, and depicts them as trying to run away from God to heaven or to Sheol or into the depths of the sea to hide themselves or to sell themselves into slavery to go hide out in a foreign nation, like God was a territorial God. And if you went and made your tent among peoples elsewhere, he couldn't find you, as if he were one of the gods of the nations who had a certain kind of limited reach or limited presence. And he sort of explodes it. Interestingly, the same imagery that for the believer is great consolation, heaven, death, remotest part of the sea, even there your hand will lead me, your right hand will lead me. We say these things and we take consolation. The unbeliever tries to flee to those places with the delusion that somehow he gets away from the presence of God. And of course, Amos says, no, that's not the case. So we find this extensive and intensive omnipresence. God is as near to you as your very active being. There is no place in his creation where we hide ourselves from him. For the believer, a great consolation. For the unbeliever, a dreadful truth, dreadful reality. All right, that's where we came to last week, as we looked at sort of biblical foundation of God's omnipresence. We haven't quite gotten into a few clarifications I want to hit today, two in particular. The first is how to understand God's omnipresence with respect to texts that seem to indicate that there is a sort of locational presence of God, the idea that God can be here as opposed to there. People among whom God doesn't dwell. How can God not dwell among people if he in fact is omnipresent and fills heaven and earth? And again, I want to kind of get into this idea of manifested presence as categorically something different and not contradictory to immensity. And I want us to not get confused in this. When we talk about divine immensity, we're talking about this presence of God in his being as the giver of being, as the sustainer of being, as the providential Lord whose kingdom rules over all. In this respect, God is not more or less present to anything and in any place. With respect, though, to his showing of himself, and by showing of himself, I mean the use of phenomenological instruments. I'll explain what I mean by that in a second, not to baffle you, but the use of phenomenological instruments to manifest or show himself, both with regard to his favor and with regard to his displeasure. God uses the created order and instruments in the created order, and the instruments, and this is what I mean by phenomenological instruments, I mean created realities that are employed by God to disclose himself to us in particular places and at particular times in particular ways. So not going into all the texts because we could just chase these down for the rest of our time, what sort of phenomenological instruments does God use to show himself? You know a couple, so. Yeah, pillar of cloud and fire come to mind. Those are the prominent ones in Israel's exodus and sojourn. And then, of course, that sort of abiding Shekinah glory, which I like to say, God in himself dwells in inapproachable light. No man has seen or can see, but there is a light that we can see. That I like to call that the approachable light. That is to say, manifested light. There is this unmanifested light. If you remember our talk about incomprehensibility, where Elihu talks about how God is shrouded in great glory, but he says, God, we cannot find him, and that's a good thing. It's saying that there's a beyondness to God that lies beyond the presentation of glory that we see. God is not captured, circumscribed by, or completely contained inside the manifestation of his glory. He always exceeds even the most glorious manifestation of himself. Okay. That being said, he still makes himself known and shows himself through these phenomena, pillar a fire, cloud, other phenomena, not always visible, sometimes audible, thunder on top of the mountain, you know, the kind that shakes your bones, that kind of thunder, shows himself that, but sometimes not in thunder, right? Sometimes, you know, remember Elijah down there, actually on the same mountain, fascinating, on the same mountain down there in the Sinai, thinks God is in the thunder, but he's not. Where is he there? It's audible. In the still small voice. So God uses, so we have fire in the bush, we have the pillar of fire, we have the cloud, we have the Shekinah glory, we have thunder, we have still small voices. There are other ways, sometimes in angelic form. Some of the angel of the Lord passages are in fact theophanic, that is to say, they are the Lord appearing in angelic form. Sometimes he doesn't appear how would we say this? Angelomorphically, sometimes he appears theomorphically, anthropomorphically, appears in the form of man. So in Genesis 18, three men come and sit down outside Abraham's tent, and Sarah goes and prepares a meal, and we are told that two of them are angels, and that one of them is clearly identified by Moses writing this under inspiration as Yahweh. So he appears in angel form. He appears in human form. He appears in the form of fire and light, and he appears in the form of cloud, and he appears in the form of thunder, and he appears in the form of still small voices. In other words, what we're saying is, and these, by the way, all of these are locational manifestations. And what I want to say is, this doesn't mean that God's being is more present in those places, but there is a sense in which God's manifestation of being is uniquely concentrated and displayed in different places and different times. We also get this description of God in sometimes very locomotive language, locational and locomotive activity. We looked briefly at Genesis 11. The rebels on the plain of Shinar are building a tower to heaven to make a great name for themselves. In verse 5, it says, Yahweh came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men have built. Verse 7, he says, come, let us go down there and confuse their language so that they do not understand one another. What's the picture here? Is the picture that God is zipping around the cosmos at the speed of light, but sometimes here and sometimes there, so that he can get there quickly? I don't think that that's what we're supposed to be thinking. I don't even think that we're supposed to be thinking that God in heaven is actually not present here, and so that when God is present here confusing the tongues, he's absent there. In other words, I don't think that we're supposed to derive this idea that God is sometimes here and sometimes there, and every time he's here, he's not everywhere else he could be. It's not something like that. It's actually anthropomorphic in the sense that he's describing himself in the ordinary language of a monarch. And when the monarch hears about a rebellion in some corner of his empire, he goes out, gets on the horse, gets his men, goes out to the place where the rebellion is taking place, and he investigates and exacts the punishment needed if that's required. And the idea is not that God is constrained by space and has to move here and move there, but like monarchs who do move here and there in order to deal effectively with the affairs of their kingdom, God deals effectively with the affairs of his kingdom. And he's using this anthropomorphic imagery to describe it. Also, God will reveal himself in terms of covenantal favor and fellowship at times. Genesis 3, they heard the sound of Yahweh God walking in the garden in the cool of the day, and the man and his wife hid themselves. I take it that this is here's an audible phenomena. They heard his sound. Now, sound as we understand it, is produced by some physical disruption or agitation of airwaves, right? That then you hear them because they then agitate little inner bones inside your inner ear. That's what's happening, right? Hits your eardrum and tickles those little bones inside there and sends the signal to your brain and says, I'm hearing this. But God isn't a physical entity. God doesn't actually have vocal cords over which air passes and is made to vibrate and then, you know, affect air. So how do they hear the sound of God walking in the garden in the cool of the day? I'll leave off the walking for a second. How do they hear this sound? I take it that God is deploying created media, in this case airwaves, to make his presence known. And in a kind of phenomenal and real time and space sensible way, show himself. Say, I'm here. The sound of the Lord God walking, Pastor Dunn and I have discussed this. I'm of the mind that this just may be an anthropomorphic way of saying, of describing walking. In other words, does this mean God literally appears in, you know, I like to say bipedal upright hominoid form, you know, a man taking a walk with steps through a garden? Maybe. It could mean that. I think Pastor Dunn leans that way. I lean that maybe it's not that way, but the reason I lean that way, just quickly, is because God does describe himself as walking among the people of Israel in a tent and in a tabernacle. And by that, he doesn't mean walking with 2 feet in hominoid form. He means going along with. But Pastor Dunn would also have good reasons why he might lean the other. I don't know. It's been a few years since we discussed it. Didn't wreck our fellowship at all. didn't affect us in the least. We both agree on this, that God uses created media to make himself known in peculiar ways in place and in time. This is not a curtailment or a reducing or nullifying of his omnipresence. I think that's the point I'm wanting to make here. This is not God's immensity sort of being dialed down so he can be here or there. Okay, so we don't want to see this manifested presence as somehow in tension with his filling heaven and earth or being as near to each of his creatures as their very act of being. It's not an either-or proposition. It's a both-and. As creator, sustainer of all things, there's nowhere God is not fully present in the totality of his being, making all things be. With regard to his historic dealings and manifesting of himself with creatures, both for good and ill, these sorts of manifestations are locationally and temporally conditioned, appearing at different times, in different ways, at different places, for different purposes, depending on the individual and the situation. He appears to various men at different locations. He appears at times to Abraham and makes promises to him, speaks to him as to a friend. Also to Moses, he comes down to Sinai and he uses the same language of coming down. He comes down to Sinai and meets with Moses, speaks with Moses, shows himself through fire and thunder to the people. Also, with regard to his dwelling, he dwells differently with his people than he does with those who are not his elect. Among his covenantal people, there's a manifestation of favorable nearness that is not manifested or apparent to those who are not his people. In the Old Testament, Exodus 25, verse 8, gives a good description of this. He says, "Let them construct a sanctuary for me, that I may dwell among them." Obviously, this is not the dwelling of omnipresence. This is something else. The dwelling of omnipresence is never more here or there and does not require a tent or anything like this. When it says, "Let them make a tent for me," or a sanctuary that I may dwell among them, the idea is, dwell among them in a peculiar manifestative way. Dwell among them in a way where they sense, and I think this is the whole issue, sensing, that they sense my nearness in an unusual way. The usual way you sense his nearness is this. Do you draw breath? Then he is near, because we receive from him life, breath, and all things. Are you, as opposed to not, are you convinced you exist? Not to get into some kind of heady, you know, idealist philosophy or something. Are you convinced you exist? I'm just going to take it that you are. And if you're not convinced, see me immediately afterward.
I'll try to convince you before the morning service. Well, then he is that near to, he is as near as that to you. So it's not the ordinary sense of presence, but that this tabernacling is some kind of extraordinary manifestation. Not the manifestation of immensity, the manifestation of covenantal favor, or as we'll see in a moment, disfavor or displeasure. So he dwells among his people in the sanctuary in a way that he doesn't dwell among, I take it, all peoples who do not have his sanctuary among them. He also dwells in Jerusalem in a way that he does not dwell in other places. We could say this, he dwells in Israel in a way he doesn't in the nations, but in Israel he dwells in the city of Jerusalem in a way that he doesn't dwell in other cities. Let me make sure I'm looking at the right text. Exodus 20, verse 24. I'm in the wrong place. I'll look. Oh, Psalm 135:21. Maybe that's a better. Psalm 135:21. Blessed be Yahweh from Zion, who dwells in Jerusalem. Praise Yahweh. Praise the Lord. So that in Israel, there's a dwelling of God in one city. He dwells among Israel in a way he doesn't dwell among the nations, but even in Israel, he dwells in one city in a way that he doesn't dwell in the other cities. And if we could get more precise about this, even within that city, he dwells in one place, one hill in particular, in a way that he doesn't dwell in the others. He dwells on the hill of Zion in a way that is manifestatively different than the way that he is present, say, in the city of David or in the other parts of the city that are outside of that holy hill. So here's a holy city, but inside the holy city, there's a holy hill in which he manifests himself on that hill in a way that he doesn't, like, say, on the higher hill right across the Kidron Valley, which you know of as the Mount of Olives. Mount Zion is actually a little lower than the Mount of Olives. And is just to the west across a tiny valley from it. And yet his presence is there in a way that it's not on that hill higher, just right across this tiny valley. And even there, I won't go through all the texts that I have listed. Well, we can look at a couple. Psalm 9, verse 11. He says, sing praises to Yahweh who dwells in Zion. Declare among the peoples his deeds. There's a sense in which he dwells in Jerusalem, but in Jerusalem on Mount Zion in particular. I have another text I need to make sure that I'm looking at the right one. 1 Kings 8, verses 10 through 13. Right. It happened then that the priests came from the holy place. Clouds filled the house of Yahweh so the priests could not stand and minister before the cloud, for the glory of the Lord filled the house of the Lord. Then Solomon said, the Lord has said that he would dwell in the thick cloud. I have surely built you a lofty house, a place for your dwelling forever. So you have a set-apart city of God's presence. You have a hill inside the city of God's presence. You have a building on that hill of God's presence. And you even have a certain sense in which God is more manifestatively present in certain parts of that building than he is in others. You have a holy place, but then you also have a holy of holies, a smaller room in which, in terms of the furniture, beside the two great seraphs on either end whose wings touch, spanning the whole width of the room, you have another well-known object inside that room, which is the mercy seat, the Ark of the Covenant. And on the lid, it's interesting, you could say the Ark of the Covenant, but you were more precise. It's actually the mercy seat, the lid of the Ark of the Covenant, the mercy seat being that centerpiece on the lid between the two smaller seraphs carved and adorning the top of that lid whose wings touch. And we're actually told that God dwells between the cherubim. Psalm 80, verse 1. Oh, give ear, shepherd of Israel, who led Joseph like a flock. You are enthroned above the cherubim. Shine forth. I take it that this is asking for Shekinah, looking for a showing of your glory. Not knowing he's glorious is one thing, but seeing that glory, in a certain sense, shown forth in a created manifestation, a created disclosure of himself, is what the psalmist is seeking for. Asaph is saying, "You sit above the cherubim." He's asking that he would shine forth from that place, that the Shekinah would be uniquely shining forth from that locality. Psalm 99, verse 1, I think also gives us this locational manifestation. Yahweh reigns, let the peoples tremble. He is enthroned above the cherubim, let the earth shake. There's a sense in which God's, you know, it says that God sits enthroned above the circle of the earth in Isaiah 40. But here he shows his enthronement. He shows this sovereign rule from a particular place. He can't think of it like this. He condescends to show us his sovereign enthronement in a locality. In this case, between the cherubim. The point that we're making is simply this. None of this is contradictory to God's omnipresence. This is something else. This is manifestated presence. This is presence of covenantal nearness and favor. It's also a way in showing covenantal displeasure. When Israel persists in sin and fails in that covenant made at Sinai, what happens to the glory of the Lord that shines forth from the Holy of Holies? What happens to it? Departs, uses the slang. How, if God fills heaven and earth, how can he depart? Do you see what I'm getting at? There's nowhere to go. Right? Again, I don't take it that that's an omnipresent statement. It's not saying that God's omnipresence is like a force field that is sometimes weak and sometimes strong. Literally, there is no, if we want to speak of it this way, in with respect to God's being, there is no truly godless place. Even, and we talked about this last week briefly with Sheol, if that means hell. I don't think that that's the main point. But even there, the question, you know, I always get this from undergrads, is God present in hell? The answer is yes. Yes, in terms of he is the one who makes it be. He's the one who makes it to exist as opposed to not. He, of course, creates and sustains the very existence of all creatures, whether under condemnation or whether under his blessing. So in the sense of as creator, he is present in hell. I would also say he's present in hell in a special manifestative way. He is present in hell showing himself holy and opposed to wickedness. Do the wicked in hell see God manifested in any way whatsoever? And the answer is yes. They wish it were not so, but yes. Now, this is not the presence of God that consoles you and me. This is the presence of God that condemns and terrifies. Maybe a brief look at that. Amos. I mentioned Amos. We should look at him briefly. Amos chapter 9 is a great example of sort of manifested presence, but this time in hostility. Not the shining forth of Shekinah warming and consoling God's people, but the shining forth of the holy consuming fire that God is. Amos chapter 9, verses 1 to 4. strong language. Let's jump in, though. "Hear this word, you cows of Bashan, who are on the mountains of Samaria, who oppress the poor, who crush the needy, who say to your husbands, 'Bring now that we may have drink.'" He says, I'm looking at chapter 9. "Thus says the Lord, standing beside the altar, I saw the Lord standing beside the altar, and he said, 'Smite the capitals so that the threshold will shake, and break them on the heads of them all.'" Briefly. So he sees the Lord. This is a manifestation of the Lord, and the Lord is standing in a particular place. He sees the Lord, and he sees the Lord manifested as being somewhere, okay? In this case, beside the altar. "Smite the capitals so that the thresholds will shake," that is to say, the big heavy part on top of the pillars, "break them off and throw them down on the people below it." That's the picture. "Break them on the heads of them all, and I will slay the rest of them with the sword. They will not have a fugitive who will flee or a refugee who will escape." And then it talks about the attempt of men to escape God's presence. In this case, God's presence in, by the way, This is exactly what Adam and Eve were fleeing from in the garden that day. They were fleeing from the presence of God, now which they knew because of their sin would be manifested against them in opposition. God says to Israel, after Israel disowns him as father, God says, "I've turned myself to become their enemy." There's a sense in which that's how it appears to us. God deals with sinners as with enemies, not as with sons. And enemies don't like to stand there and take it when the one opposed to them shows up. So he says, there will be no refugee who escapes, none will flee. Verse 2, though they dig into Sheol, from there my hand will take them. It's interesting. David starts with, though I ascend to heaven. These start with descending to Sheol. Quick suggestion on what might be taking place here. He might be talking about suicide. They're his enemies. God is opposed to them. Though they dig into Sheol, that's the grave, my hand will take them. I think in a broad application, he's talking about people who try to escape the presence and the opposition of God by taking their own life, by fleeing to the realm of the dead. In other words, I'll get away from God's displeasure if I kill myself. I think that's probably the idea. Though they dig into the grave, from there my hand will take them. Though they ascend to heaven, from there I will bring them down. Though they hide on the summit of Carmel, I will search them out and take them from there. Though they conceal themselves from my sight on the floor of the sea, from there I will command the serpent and it will bite them. Verse 4, though they go into captivity before their enemies, from there I will command the sword and it will slay them. Again, this idea is, if I immigrate, If I sell myself into the dominion of my enemies serve another god, and therefore when they take me into their territory, I will be in the territory of their god, not the god who's against me. This is the whole thing, though. An omnipresent God isn't a territorial God. That is to say, he's not a god of this place as opposed to that place. He's not a god of the mountains as opposed to a god of the plains. He's not a god of the sea as opposed to a god of the skies or something like this. This is why when Jonah says to the sailors on the ship, you know, I serve the God who made the heaven and earth, the sea and dry land, and the soldiers begin to shake and quiver because they realize this one he worships is not a territorial god like the gods of all the nations from whom you can flee. I take it with success. You can actually get away. There's an escape plan from every god who does not fill heaven and earth. There's a possibility. There's some way out of his presence. And then, of course, out away from his long arm of power. This is not, and that's how the wicked delude themselves. When they flee from the presence of God, they imagine idolatrously that God is like one of the gods whose dominion is but of a particular territory. There's a getaway plan. You can go somewhere that exists that God isn't. This completely fails to understand how God is present. He's the maker. There's nowhere that is of which he does not make it be. In other words, you're never in the place that God isn't fully active in all his power, making all things to exist. The realm of the dead, the heavens, wherever you may go, the heights of the mountains, the bottom of the sea. This is, again, this whole delusion turns on this kind of idolatrous conception of God as a finite entity. Anyway, he says, though they go into captivity before their enemies, from there I'll command the sword and it will slay them. And then he says this, and I take it that this is what his presence in hell is like. And I will set my eyes against them for evil and not for good. Okay. So with regard to the question, is God present in hell? Not in manifested covenantal favor. Not with a smile, as it were, not with kindness in his eyes, you know, if I could say it this way, not with his face shining upon them, but with his face frowning, with his eyes set for evil. Of course, the presence of God is actually what makes hell so horrific. It's that the one who is present is the Almighty God, and he is not present to do you good, right? But rather to recompense evil. So if I could blend these two things together, the ground of God's power in manifesting himself here and there and in this way and that is his omnipresence. Okay, so that the reason God is able to show himself so variously and in variegated ways in different places and different times is because God is already present in all places and at all times as the maker and the sustainer of being. So there is a sense in which his omnipresence undergirds and supports his manifested presence. But we don't want to take his manifested presence in all of its variations to sort of contradict or conflict with his omnipresence. All right, that's my first clarification. You know what? The clock is not on here. but I have one on my wrist. So, all right, let's go to the second. Let's go to the second clarification. This one is a little bit more. How can I say this? This one is perhaps a little bit more contemplative in the way that we do theology. It's trying to sort of give a clarification with regard to omnipresence by saying this, that God is not present in the way that we as physical and finite entities are present to a place. I am present to this podium in a way in which I'm not present to you. I'm nearer to this than I am to you. There's a sense in which my presence is a sort of coordinatable presence. You could plot me longitudinally and latitudinally. And you could say I am here and thereby identify everywhere I'm not as well. And also there's a sense in which my presence is a space sharing presence. In that my presence here and the presence of the podium here means that we have to sort of clear out for each other. Okay? If I want to take over the space presently occupied by the podium, I'm going to have to. Took its space, right? Took it away. And it took this unoccupied spot here to the side. All right, I'm going to give it its space back, front and center. It's a nice spot for it. But the point is, I can't be present to the places already occupied. See what I'm getting at? You are sitting on these comfortable pews. We have wooden pews at our church. So you're sitting nice and comfortably on these padded pews. You're occupying a space just above the seat and just in front of the back. But you're not occupying the same space. To the extent you're occupying the space, I take it your bench isn't, and vice versa. We don't want to think of God's omnipresence as the omnipresence of one who shares space with us, as the one who's fitting in where there's room. That's how you and I are present to places. We fit in where there's available space, and we don't go where the space is already occupied. This is because our presence is the presence of extended spatial entities. When we say God is omnipresent, what we don't mean, this is by way of clarification, we don't mean that God is omnispatial, because God is not a being that is extended in space, requiring space in order to be present. You and I, as material beings in that respect, we require some space in order to be there. God isn't present to space in this way because God isn't a space occupier. He's not a distended material entity that requires room. Okay? So that we also don't mean then that God's presence is basically filling in all the cracks. Okay? You know, the places where he can get to. What does this mean then? This means that God, if I want to say it positively, this means that God, insofar as he is not competing with us for spatial presence, is also not precluded or ruled out of or banished from any spatial entity. Because God is not sharing space with us, because that's not the way he's present, it also means that the presence of other things cannot push his presence out. Does this make sense? So that this podium, try as I might, pushes me out. I can't occupy this space so long as this thing does. And this thing resists my presence at just the extent at which it is already occupying the space. God's presence is not competing because it's not of the same order as spatial entities. So does this mean that God is present, if we can say it this way, inside of the podium? I'm not. I'm quite solidly kept out. Okay? There's a sense in which my presence has a limit. The limit of my presence is where the presence of this thing begins and rules me out. So we're sharing presence. And I'm necessarily absent from all the things to which my being does not extend and which is already occupied by other beings. God is not absent or having his presence curtailed to just this extent. God rather is present not just around or near or proximate to things, but he is also present in the things themselves. Not as in some weird way another spatial thing crowding into, you know, space with other spatial things, but as the one who is the very reason and immediate source for which, through which all things are. God's presence is as the maker of all things. God's presence is as the one who upholds all things, rules all things, in whom all things have their very being and existence. God is present in that way. You and I aren't present that way to anything. We are not creators in this absolute sense of making things be. We give shape and form to things, and we push and pull on entities that are out there, and we manipulate them into items that are serviceable to us. We make cars, and we make loaves of bread, and we take the, you know, we take the material stuff in the world, and we sort of create by pushing, pulling, reconfiguring, and reducing it into some kind of serviceable thing. Grains into bread, metals into car frames, rubber into tires, cotton into clothing. In other words, you see what I'm getting at? So that we create by sort of manipulating the things with which we share space. Okay? God's presence and God's work in creation is not God sort of coming to, in a certain sense, already existing things and then pushing, pulling, manipulating, shaping. So that God's omnipresence is not like the omnipresence of a cosmic manipulator. That's not quite right. It's the presence of the universal cause of all being, the universal source of everything, not himself. He exists in and of himself. He is his own being. He is his own reason for being, but he's also your reason for being. For himself, he simply exists because his name is I Am. For you, you exist because he wills you to. This is God's presence in you, the presence of making you be. I always like to say, because sometimes people feel like omnipresence is suffocating them, okay? Sort of invading their space. And we like space. I like private space. And, you know, when I talk to you, I'm about an 18-inch minimum guy. You know, I like about that much at least. That's okay. That's good. We can have a good conversation right there. I don't. Anywhere under 12, and you'll see me stepping back, okay? Because there's a sense in which we want some space, and we can feel invaded even by people that we love. There's a sense in which our sort of private universe, that little whatever that zone is, for some of you it's longer than others, but whatever that zone is, we don't want to be crowded. And omnipresence feels like the ultimate crowding out doctrine. God's omnipresence is invading me. It's inconvenienced me. Listen, it's not that God's invading you. It's more profound than that. Without his omnipresence present in power to make you be, there'd be no you there. So it's something more profound. I told you this would be more contemplative. But there would be no you there for God to crowd out if God were not already fully present in you, making you be. God cannot manipulate or crowd out, so to speak, in some kind of sinister way, that which would not exist unless he were already fully present as the source and cause of its being. This whole in him we live, move, and have our being sort of rules out this idea that God is getting up in our space. If I can just be very clear about this, omnipresence means there is no your space with regard to God. With regard to you and me, we can negotiate that and agree on your space and my space. With regard to God, there is no negotiation on his space and your space. He's not a space sharer. That means that God's nearness to you is not invasive. There is no you, and there is no your being here or being there without God already fully present to you. You depend upon his fully present activity of making you be and sustaining your existence. So this being another implication. All right, a couple just parting shots in terms of practical applications. And this can be both threatening and encouraging. We're never alone. There's no secret place. There's no godless place. This means that for the wicked, when they think they hide themselves from God, whether that's climbing the mountains and crying out to the rocks, fall upon us and hide us, or whether that's setting up firewalls on your computer to hide out from being seen. Doesn't matter. There is no secrecy. Omnipresence explodes this whole myth of privacy. I believe in private property rights, and I believe in a relative measure of privacy from each other, but from the maker of all things and the sustainer of all things with whom we have to do, omnipresence means privacy is a myth. There's no such thing. There's no thought you're having. There's no motive of your heart that is not fully open and laid bare before the one with whom you have to do. Not because he invaded you, but because there'd be no you if he were not making you be, sustaining you, knowing you perfectly, better than you know yourself. It also means that for the unbeliever is threatening. Do not I fill heaven and earth, declares the Lord. That's a threat to the unbeliever. To the believer, the same truth is great consolation. There is no place you land. There is no thought you have. There is no something about you. There's no somewhere you are where God is not fully present. Not only playing catch up, he doesn't do that, but his right hand leading you, guiding you. Omnipresence means that you never actually end up in the place where God is not present in all his power. If you cry out to him from the other side of the world or from the remotest part of the sea, he's not somehow farther off. You don't have to cry a little louder. Right, that was the problem with the prophets of Baal, crying out, screaming, cutting themselves, and Elijah in that sort of grit, some of the biblically sanctified mockery says, you know, maybe he's taking a nap, maybe he's on vacation, maybe he's in the bathroom. We never have to. Our faith will never be susceptible to that kind of mocking, because of this truth. Means that God's our constant source of being and life. His involvement in our lives is as deep and as penetrating as our very existence. This idea that somehow I'm far from God may have some meaning with regard to your spiritual condition and your covenantal fellowship with God, but omnipresence means that if you cry out to him, there's not any remote sense in which he doesn't hear, doesn't know, and is not present to answer immediately. A statement from Augustine, I'll leave it with this and pray. Augustine says, as we cannot flee from God, let us flee to him.